calculate the attendance registered for the members.
Thank you. I think we have to start our meetings firstly in-house issues. Our cell phones, Dr. Rupna Rain, I know it might be ringing now. If you could take care of them. That's on a lighter note. We are assembling today at a meeting convened by the Portfolio Committee on Public Service and Administration, which is our slot on Wednesdays that will come together and debate issues that have to do with things that fall within our scope of work. Today we are going to consider and decide as a portfolio committee on the state of the public service report by the Public Service Commission, that is 2008 SOPS report. We are going to look at the PSC's report, the fourth consolidated monitoring and evaluation report, and we're going to reflect on the report submitted by SAMDI on the massified induction program. You will remember that we took a decision after a round table that we had looking at induction and reorientation in the public service, where somebody in qualifying their stance as a training academy of choice, I think we put it like that, they indicated that they play a role in dealing with induction. So the massified induction program was introduced. It was a round table. There were several stakeholders that were there. The Public Service Commission was there. The Department of Public Service and Administration was there. Other state departments were there, and they developed interest because this massified induction program is an induction program in public service wide, involving all departments. They raised issues which we then forwarded to SAMDI to consider. And then SAMDI is going to talk to us on those issues as to having received those issues, having given attention to those issues, having considered them, what do they have to say in as far as the induction program itself is concerned. After that presentation, we are going to decide as a committee as to whether we need a follow-up round table or we don't. It will depend on what somebody has to say on those issues. On the two reports of the Public Service Commission, as you know that we are dealing with quite a few reports of the Commission, and we have taken a stance that says we are going to reflect and take a formal decision on those reports as submitted, so that the work of the Public Service Commission may find its way through, supported by Parliament, through to the department, so that if there are recommendations that some departments have to embark on, those recommendations will then be such that Parliament has endorsed its view on the matter as led by this portfolio committee. We are fortunate today, and I want to take this opportunity at this meeting of the committee to recognize the presence of a representative from the Southern Sudan Civil Service Commission. There they are. I recognize them. You know, Civil Service Commission, I had one member saying, "Oh, Civil Service Commission, does it have anything to do with Public Service Commission?" They are the counterparts of our Public Service Commission in Southern Sudan. They are here as part of a engagement. You know, we are an international player as South Africa. All of us will remember that we stamped that position, that we are one of the nations in the international family or community of nations recognized and were international player as South Africa post that history that we had since 1994. So Professor Sangweni, the chairperson of the Public Service Commission, will introduce them, but want to say you are most welcome to this meeting. This is a meeting, as I've indicated, convened by the Portfolio Committee on Public Service and Administration. What actually happens is that Portfolio Committee meetings, Professor was saying, can we allow our guests to come and be with us? I said, Portfolio Committee meetings are public meetings. So that's why even the media is here. If they are not here, it's by choice. It's by choice, but they are actually welcome to be here so that our transparency, which is one of the characteristic features of our democracy, is actually practicalized. So that is why I then said, that being the case, they will be most welcome to be here, observe. The only thing that will miss, Professor Sangwe, from them is that they may observe, but they may not participate in the debate. But you are most welcome, colleagues from Southern Sudan. And can I then say, Prof, you then introduce them, then from there we'll go on with our meeting according to our traditional rituals. Thanks.
Fine. Thank you very much, Chair. I'm very grateful to you in the first place for facilitating this. And in your opening remarks, I think you have summarized it very, very well, the context in which these our sisterly and brotherly people from Southern Sudan are here. I'm grateful indeed for that opportunity. The chairperson of the Southern Sudan Civil Service Commission is Mr. Deng Malang. You notice I emphasize the Malang at the end of the name. He is the chairperson of the Southern Sudan Civil Service Commission. And accompanying him is the Executive Secretary, or in our language here, the Director General of the Southern Sudan Civil Service Commission, Ms. Jocelyn Apollo, seated next to our Director General. As you have said, Chair, indeed, we have been building up a working relationship with the Southern Sudan Civil Service Commission in the past 18 months or so. To date, we have entered and agreed a memorandum of understanding under which we here in South Africa will be extending to our colleagues in Southern Sudan the expertise that by virtue of our experience we have learned over the years. But also, it's not a teacher-pupil relationship. We also in that process are going to learn quite a great deal from the experiences of Southern Sudan. Chair, I am grateful to you, as I say, for giving this opportunity. But also, as you have just very correctly put it, this is also a lesson I trust to our visitors, that in our democracy there are various aspects, and we have mentioned a very important one, transparency. There is nothing to hide in what we do here, and I think this demonstrates it very well. Thank you very much, Chair, and also the honorable members for accepting our guests and our visitors from Southern Sudan. Thanks.
Once more, thanks, Prof. I think the committee will accept when we later say we would like to also say have an experience sharing with our counterpart in Southern Sudan. as to then say how Parliament and the Civil Service Commission relate to one another, how they actually give support. You know, it's an interesting thing to do, as you know, that our Public Service Commission established in terms of the Constitution, centrally placed to be what we call the custodian of good governance. We all know that the success of the Public Service Commission in executing their mandate actually rests on the support that they get from Parliament. So at some stage, maybe Mr. Marang, is it Mr. Marang? Malang. Maybe we may find ourselves one day visiting your country so that we have this experience sharing with our counterpart, which is members of Parliament there. We are a multi-party portfolio committee. I did not indicate that because our South African Parliament is multi-party. So members will introduce themselves. They have even forgotten, you know, when we deal with committee work, our focus is more on committee work, that members even forget the parties they represent. Put the interest of the state in the party first. Thanks very much. Now, back to our normal program. We received two apologies. So Simons and Mr. Nyambi. Mr. Nyambi is attending a meeting. We are going to reflect when we look at our program going forward. The State Information Technology Agency is having a closed meeting today with the Department of Home Affairs. They are looking at some of the issues. So they extended an invitation. They wanted the chairperson to be there. But then because of this meeting, we then said, Ms. Nyambi will have to represent us there. We are going to take it from that point at a later stage when we look at our program in terms of how we want to engage in that report. So we have those two apologies. Mr. Yulis. Okay, Mr. Yulis, apology. Fine, thanks. Now, can we then just introduce ourselves? We'll start with members of the committee. Samdi is here. PSC is here. We are all here. I'm Richard Baloyi, the chairperson of the committee.
Thank you, Chair. I'm Pam Tretti from the Eastern Cape.
Ngaba Chabaza, member of the committee.
Jane Matsumela, member of the committee, and apologies for late coming, Chairperson.
My name is Carol Mini, member of the committee.
Usha Rupnarayan, member of this committee and member of the IFP.
Thank you very much. They reminded us in a way. Prof, to you to introduce your delegation, I mean, and then the commissioners and officials, I see the DGCA, and then to Samdi.
Person, Civil Service Commission. In fact, it used to be called Public Service Commission, so it is the same thing, civil service or public service. It's public and it is civil.
I'm going to be civil and say good morning to everybody. I'm Norman Maharaj, a member of the Public Service Commission.
Good morning, Audit Ramsing, Public Service Commission.
I'm Mesh, the Profile Office of the Public Service Commission.
I'm Brenda Barnard from the Public Administration Leadership and Management Academy, previously SAMDI.
I'm Rufus Mutlana from Palama, previously SAMDI, and I also want to table the apology from the DG, Dr. Oken.
Can we come in there? You see, when this the minister announced Palama, when she was debating in the budget vote, I was not aware that she's talking about what is contained in the new bill. And when I read the bill, then it was then to me, oh, we are still going to debate the bill, but part of it is still being introduced. It's already being introduced. But in any case, we can't make an issue out of a name. we'll be worried if other sections of the bill are introduced before, other than just the name itself. Okay, thanks. That was on a lighter note.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Olimu Khaladi from Samdi Stroke Palam.
Morning. My name is Dumisani Klaba from the DPSA. Apologies for the TTG. Colette Clark, she's going to be joining us later.
Morning, Chair. I'm Fini Viveye from the Office of the Public Service Commission.
Thank you very much. The Palama input will be the last one. let's start with the consideration or the committee's decision on the SOPS report 2008. You'll remember colleagues that the Public Service Commission annually assess the state of our public service and publish a report. The report that has been published was tabled in Parliament, and after that report was tabled, we had interaction with the Public Service Commission where they led a debate on the report. We did that at a meeting that we call a round table. In fact, before that, the committee considered that report, the very same report was introduced before a committee of chairpersons of committees of parliament. Now what then remains is that the Public Service Commission has done their part in terms of assessing the report, which when you look at that report, it actually takes us through the transformation process, right from when we rationalized after 1994 up to where we are now, that we are talking about a debate towards a single public service. And the second part, of course, reflecting on how we fare in terms of the nine values that underpins our public administration. So we have dealt with that report insofar as engaging in a debate. What then remains is for us as a committee to take a decision to then say what are those things that we are seeing in terms of what the Public Service Commission is recommending in the report. We have a draft report, a draft committee report, which was circulated. But I want to submit that I got information, in fact, an invitation from the Public Service Commission that they've arranged a round table, organized a round table next week, Tuesday, on the 24th of June. So they'll be bringing more stakeholders. You know, when they call a round table, that's where you have all departments and possibly other stakeholders coming in to talk to the report, because the state of the public service report talks to the public service wide in terms of our departments and stuff like that. So even in terms of the findings that are there, even in terms of the recommendations that the commission is putting forward, there will be engagement at that level. So it's my view that if we may attend that round table as we're invited, Prof is still to clarify if we're invited to go and observe or to become active observers, passive or active. But there is that round table that is organized for next week, Tuesday. So it's my submission that if the committee agrees, we will then say there may be issues that may be raised at that round table which we might want to consider as a committee when we take a decision on that report, because the report is written on investigations and findings about what is going on in the public service generally. So that roundtable is so important. So that's my submission, and I want to check as to whether the committee agrees with that or not, that we don't finalize our decision on the report today because of the roundtable that is taking place next week, Tuesday. We will attend the roundtable, and then we'll then be able to table our report for consideration, our report for decision by the committee on Wednesday next week when we meet. It will be a very short meeting to deal with that. Prof, over to you.
Thank you very much, Chair. Indeed, you are correct. We are planning to host this roundtable, which in fact is what we have done now in the recent years with the State of the Public Service Report. At these roundtables, we invite stakeholders drawn from the wide range of formations in this our republic, universities, non-governmental organizations, private sector, and so on, indeed from the departments, and indeed in the past I recall we have also invited members of parliament. We found this extremely helpful, instructive, because we get the kind of feedback that enables us to build up on this very important document, which we've come to realize it is. A great deal of the improvements which we believe were effected on this State of the Public Service report have actually come from these roundtables, number one. Number two, indeed, we would value very much your, not only your attendance, but your very active participation and contribution at that roundtable, Chair. I thought I should just make that those remarks for if this would assist you in your decision. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thanks, Prof. Welcome, Bawamtim. That is the clarity. So the roundtable is on Tuesday. My proposal is there. Any reaction or response to the proposal? Member Zomet. Mr. Mene. Okay. So we agree. Thanks, agreed. We will deal with the report on Wednesday. The second item is the Public Service Commission's report on the fourth consolidated MNE. We dealt with this report at our last meeting, where, of course, it came out very clear that the monitoring and evaluation that the PSC did consolidated, including, I think, three time periods, reflected on how we actually fare in terms of the values of our public administration, through findings and stuff like that. So this report, a copy of which was circulated to all members, we are supposed to take a decision on as a committee today. Of course, there are quite a number of things that we may still have to clean. Like, for instance, when you look at the introduction part of it, those who might have gone through the report, the Public Service Commission is established in terms of Section 196 of the Constitution. I think the author, the draft, was to talk about chapters. So in the section 196, we're going to correct that and correct some other things. And also that when we talk about the constitution, it's an established tradition in the country that we don't talk about the constitution in terms of Act 108. We talk about the constitution. So if we say established in terms of the constitution, it's not necessary to quote. Those are technical, traditional issues that holds in terms of that. Also, on introduction, we'll have to also insert there is no recognition of the enabling legislation, the Public Service Commission Act. We'll have to also include that. So there is a cleaning that still needs to be done. With a view that maybe what will be critical is that I would like to invite the meeting to only focus on the recommendations part of it, because what appears under overview is exactly what we have. I think we are going to incorporate more in terms of what the PSC submitted in terms of their narrative summary on the overview. Under findings and PSC recommendations, those ones are actually as they are, unless if one will see there is a recommendation that has not been included in that. But where I would like to, on conclusion, we are going to reflect on that conclusion that is there as a draft. So let's not pay much attention about that. We can open a debate on that one as it stands. There may even be a motion to divide the committee so that we decide we are going to rework there. There are things that need to be polished there under conclusion. So I'll invite the committee to reflect on recommendations. I'm not sure if it so happened because we said in this regard, from the committee side, Mema Tomela is the one who is dealing and leading the committee to reflect and make sure that the things that we say need to be taken on board should be considered. And on the side of the Public Service Commission, it was Mr. Wu, by the way. Yeah, I'm saying I do. And we're then saying that the two should actually come together to make sure that they tighten this recommendation so that when they come here and be presented to us, they are like sort of all-inclusive. We are doing this because at the end of the day, we want to close a chapter or a gap that remains open throughout, a gap that says so much is being done by the Public Service Commission. Reports are submitted to Parliament, and so what? And want to actually deal with that. So we're trying to answer that question of so what as a portfolio committee, so that we provided it. And when we do that, it's only in situations of fight way or wars where you have ambushes, you know. But in a situation where we're dealing with the normal business, we are transparent, we also involve the commission. We would like to then say if anyone says one is not covered in terms of what we recommend in terms of the way forward, we should be in a position and be free to raise those things. So I wonder if there is anything to raise to focus on page 4 of the draft report, that's on recommendations, page 4, paragraph 5, what we are recommending there. It is possible that it's good that the DPSA is here. It's possible that we may recommend that a particular course of action should be embarked upon, only to find that what we are proposing is already in place. We don't want to be seen as if we want to reinvent the wheel in terms of our recommendations. So the recommendations are there. The first ones being that guidelines for public participation in policy making should be developed by the Department of Public Service and Administration in conjunction with the Department of Water Affairs and Forestry and the Public Service Commission. And progress with this initiative will be communicated to the committee by the 29th of August in 2008. Let's not focus more on the date, the deadline there. As a committee, we're going to look at that, because we have a very short year this year, and because we are preparing for elections next year, we might be able to look at that. But let's look at the content other than the date in terms of what we're suggesting. I think, the main issue is that the issue of public participation was found to be one area where there is room for improvement. Are we comfortable with that point, with that recommendation? Is it the absence of guidelines that you don't have active participation? Is it truly because there are no clear indications in terms of public participation now that public participation is not being done? So that I'm raising this thing so that where it's clear, where you have policies that guide us exactly in terms of what actually has to happen. You have the Watupili policy in public service. Whether that does not contribute to actually address when you say taking people first. Do we need to write guidelines at this stage, or we need to have departments internalizing the obligation of doing public participation as a way forward? And if that is what we need, why don't we say that exactly? I'm just raising this. We said we are debating issues here. I'm debating from the chair. I'm debating by way of asking these particular questions so that you don't deal with, like the issue of policy making and policy reviews. You might find that every year you are dealing with policy, you are reviewing and stuff like that, when in actual fact what you have is that you do have the policy, but the fact is that you don't have people just doing the simple thing to implement those policies. So you can't change it because people are not implementing it. You need to first look at what actually is an issue. There are people who say don't fix it if it's not broken, but others say you need to be proactive. Fix something before they are broken, if you believe they are going to be broken in no time. Can I get the views? This is a debate.
Yeah, Chairperson. We've got the legal framework very often, which is the ultimate policy in which, in this particular instance, we've got the legal framework as it's enshrined in the Constitution in terms of public participation. I don't think there's a law that governs public participation per se. But departments are not straight line sort of entities. The various departments have got their unique characteristics and very often need to develop policies internally that would guide and would address the uniqueness of those departments on many of the issues. So what we have are frameworks in terms of the law, in terms of the Constitution, and in some instances we have produced guidelines, for example, on recruitment and selection. It's one of the areas that we've highlighted as a weakness in one of the in some of the departments, where we brought that guideline, the toolkit, and we're saying that should be used as a guideline amongst other things. But from a policy point of view, to implement frameworks as it's contained in the Constitution or one of the legal frameworks, departments need to address it to speak to their specific characteristics within their departments, and that's really what we are talking about. In this particular instance, on public participation, there's a very specific one, the request that maybe that the DPSA, together with one of the departments that seemed to have performed very admirably in this particular area, was the Department of Water Affairs and Forestry, to maybe in consultation actually assist with this gap that we find in some of the other departments around public participation in policy making. Because what we know is that we see that all the time, where departments, in fact, advertise for comments around some of the policies in the newspapers. Is this enough? Should there be a greater engagement with the citizens
before a policy is actually accepted, on whatever level, whether it is environmental affairs and sea fisheries around. For example, you know that the abalone case that they were challenged in court, that there was not sufficient public participation around a policy to abandon the harvesting of abalone. So really this is what we are saying. So it's not a straight line sort of situation. Where in fact there are unique characteristics within the department, we are in fact saying the departments must then use that policy to address those unique situations in order for it to be implemented properly.
Thanks. Further comments on this issue? You know, what comes to mind also, you know, when you talk of public participation, of course it depends on the issue that you are addressing. If it is the legislation that you are dealing with, you know, what to do, if it is governance issues, we know what we're doing. We do have imbizos, for instance. Are they not fora of public participation, the imbizos? And if they are, what is lacking in the imbizos that then suggests that we need to actually have guidelines? Or is it because some departments take it like it's a question of, it's an option to do public participation? They don't look at it as like a something that is like a must do a kind of a thing. At local government level, we have the IDPs, the IDP program, but that happens when they actually deal with budgets and stuff like that. I'm raising this question so that when we ultimately agree that we adopt this recommendation, we know exactly what needs to be done, so that you don't adopt a recommendation which at the end of the day it will be difficult for you to implement because it's not implementable. So let's look. I saw two hands. Odette and Mesh first. And Mema Tomel.
Thanks, Chairperson. I will be more inclined to go in the direction that Commissioner Maharaj is proposing, because I think if we recommend that DPSA, for example, takes the responsibility for developing guidelines, the risk that we run here is as we have seen in certain instances, is departments which then do not do anything in this area and say we are waiting for DPSA to develop guidelines. I think the Constitution is very clear on this matter, and the particular principle of consultation is very clear and on this matter at the normative level, that departments must ensure that the public is involved in policy making and policy implementation. So the direction that then holds departments accountable for ensuring that participation takes place, I think it's is the one I would recommend that is taken. And it's only when departments then say, well, this is what we have in place, and perhaps there are gaps in what they have in place, that assistance can be considered. But the issue is you have departments that have been able to put something in place. Why have they been able to do that, whilst others haven't? So they have to be held accountable for ensuring that there is something in place, and where they are struggling, assistance can then be provided. Just to give an example here, in terms of the guidelines, I think there is always the temptation that when you say, well, what guidelines, have you got guidelines on public participation, that people will say, well, we do is in BISO, or we consult on IDPs. But those are not guidelines. I think what should be put in place, if you look at what other departments have done, you want to say, as a department, these are the forms of participation that we will promote. And this is how often we will ensure that these forms of participation are promoted. And Izimbizo could be one of them. But you don't mention Izimbizo and say it's a set of guidelines. And these are the forms that we will promote. And once we have received inputs from stakeholders, this is how we'll ensure that the inputs are processed. And once those inputs have been processed, this is how we'll ensure that there is another leg of feedback back to the stakeholders to say this is how we have dealt with the inputs that we are talking about. So these are basic and minimum consultation requirements that, that departments need to put in place, as opposed to simply saying, well, we do citizen satisfaction survey. How do those surveys then fit within a set of guidelines that the department has approved?
No, thanks. You covered, or comfortable. Memo Tomela, and then Commissioner Maharaj.
Chairperson, I'm doubtful as to whether I should say something before Commissioner Maharaj.
I just wanted to, for completeness sake, wanted to add that we've got an Administrative Justice Act. And I think within that environment as well, because policy making is about administrative justice, and fair administration requires there to be a policy and a protocol in terms of decision making within departments. So that's a particular law that I say, I asked earlier on, is there a legal framework around it other than the Constitution? So the Constitution, read with the Administrative Justice Act, should be able to guide departments around that. And I mentioned court cases, because if you do get challenged in the court in terms of an administrative action, the courts would want to know, under, you know, what policy guided you in terms of that administrative action. And in the absence of a policy, you're likely to lose your court challenge by some serious stakeholders. So, you know, the departments actually face a serious risk if they don't have policies, if they don't have guidelines in terms of how they make and take administrative decisions. I really just wanted to add that. Sorry, Honorable Matsavela.
Thanks, Chairperson. I've looked at all these recommendations, Chair, and I'm afraid if we were to go through them the way we are doing, we are going to end up reopening the discussions that we had last week. What was supposed to happen was that we should have met with Mr. Naiju, which unfortunately did not happen. When I look at this, I realize that the recommendations that we made as a committee and those that were made by the PSC have not been aligned, specifically because that meeting did not take place. And some of the recommendations that were specifically raised for the committee and public and parliament to follow up on have not been included here. So, Chairperson, I prefer if you suggest from the chair, but I would rather we complete this document before we have this kind of discussion. Without, I hope we'll not be delaying the process. But I'm afraid we're going to start all over again.
There was a copy of the input made by Mema Tomela, representing the views that as you look at them, if that could be made available. I'm afraid we have to finalize this report now, so that we don't, you know, I can't remember on what it's a public consumption. One of the strong organizations, trade union federation in this country, said that we should not act like, you know, broken cities. A broken city will keep on repeating one and the same thing. I want us to put this report behind us so that we must be able to find to deal with the other reports. Let's just avoid repetition. But I found this exercise very assisting, because on this recommendation, the first one, what we are saying is that instead of saying guidelines should be developed by each department, what I'm hearing is, I mean, by the Department of Public Service. What I'm hearing is that it should be by each department. They will actually look at their very own specific circumstances and guided by the unique features of each department and their priorities. I think that one is very helpful for us to then change or amend that recommendation there. The issue I wanted to raise was whether the DPSA may not provide a framework. But also when you look at that, you look in terms of what we have already, Paja, Batupili, all those things. Honestly speaking, if there is a department that may not be able to, that will say we need a framework, that will be a new department, and I don't think we are about to form a new department. So even if we do, those who will constitute that new department will be South Africans who obviously are part of what is happening on a day-to-day basis. So I think we're taking that one. If we'll just move with speed, the second recommendation, we are done in terms of that. So those things of water affairs and all those things are going to be taken out, but we'll then say each department will have to then deal with those things. And in fact, we checked this according to the ATC, announcement, tablings, and committee report is an instrument of communication between authorities of parliament and portfolio committee. This report is referred to us for consideration as a portfolio committee, not necessarily to report back to parliament. If we report back, it's our choice. But if we then say this is our decision, once we then say this must happen, it means we are going to make sure that actually happens. Driving that as a portfolio committee ourselves. So we might want to even rethink in terms of whether we want to put this as recommendations or as decisions, so that even when we report, if we decide to do that, it must be decisions of this committee. The second point, departments as per the PSA report should put in place a strategy of prioritizing skills development activities. Straightforward.
Thanks, Chair. I want to comment on the second one, but through your permission, I would like also to link it to the third recommendation, because I think they are related. I'm looking at this particular recommendation, Chair. First of all, I think we may want to have a date there, to because it's open-ended. It may not encourage the department to respond to this particular recommendation. But I wanted to think broader than the two recommendations, Chair, to say that if we are requesting that departments should put in place strategies of priority and skills, we need to look at this particular recommendation within the context of the Human Resource Development Strategy for the Public Service, which requires, among other things, departments to report to DPSA on regular basis in terms of prioritizing particular skills and reporting on programs, capacity building programs. And I think we may want to reword it, especially if one also takes into account the workplace skills plans developed by departments which are submitted to PCPA on annual basis, and even reports towards those work, reporting against those workplace skills plans, which ultimately leads to sector skills plans. Therefore, what I'm trying to do is that it looks like a good recommendation in terms of prioritizing skill development activities, but we need to locate it within the existing framework or structures which are currently operational without having to create another reporting mechanism. That's one. But if you look at the second one, Chair, where some of these also implicated, the whole question of ensuring that activities that have happened are implemented, and the assessment of impact of training from a monitoring perspective. And we are recommending here that departments should work with somebody in monitoring those activities. Currently, or somebody has been doing monitoring evaluation of its own training program, but from a different perspective. They are doing that monitoring from a perspective of improving the programs and ensuring that they've got the required impact. But if I look at this particular request or recommendation on monitoring, it seems to be more of a compliance to the planned activities in terms of capacity building rather than improvement of programs. And again, if we keep it like this. It's again too broad to say departments will work in consultation with somebody to conduct this. But the impression which is created is that somebody will wait and await departments to approach it to do this particular work. I think we may want to beef it up and give it some kind of a punch to say that who will be the lead sort of entity in this particular case. Like as I'm proposing in the second one, that the lead entity could be DPSA, given the link between DPSA and PCTA on workplace skills plans. Thanks.
Chairperson, if I may, I don't know what my colleague has just said on recommendation number two. We've actually given departments a deadline in terms of coming up with strategies on skills development activities. We've given them a deadline of the end of November this year for implementation in the next financial year, taking into account that they would have developed the workplace skills plans by the 30th of June, submitted to the line sitters and the PCTA. And that information flowing from the workplace skills plan submitted would then constitute part of the HRD implementation activities that they will submit to DPSA by the end of November. The processes that we have begun to capacitate sectors and capacitate offices of the Premier in terms of guiding departments in developing the HRD annual implementation plans. So I'm agreeing with my colleague on the fact that there should be a deadline in the recommendation. However, we've taken the lead of giving departments a kind of a lead in terms of when they should submit these kinds of strategies.
No, thanks. Further comments? So which means we may then see we will have to revise this recommendation just to realign it with work that has already been initiated by the Department of Public Service and Administration, but put a time frame. Also put a lead institution to then say it actually has to be happening like that. Can we agree on that? In terms of, somebody said we must give it a punch. In terms of getting the right size of a punch, in terms of coming with a specific recommendation, we can say as we continue with considering the other recommendations, we then say if we can have volunteers to be revising this recommendation. Because at the end of the day, I want this meeting to adopt this report so that what remains will be to clean in terms of the areas where there are some technical corrections to be done. But then otherwise, we'll then have to adopt the report as a committee. So, sure, thanks for volunteering. The fourth. Yeah, we have merged the second and the third. A review of the disciplinary codes and procedures will be done with a view of tightening enforcement of disciplinary procedures, specifically related to absenteeism. The public service Department of Public Service should report back to the committee by that. That's the thing. A review of the disciplinary codes of procedures. One more question: is it in the codes? There isn't. I mean, whatever finding in terms of an anomaly. Okay, Mr. Robinson.
Just in terms of that bullet point and the last bullet point, we must remember that since 2004, if not earlier, since 2002, there's been a number of reviews that have taken place in terms of the disciplinary code and procedure. My view would be we really need to track and assess to what extent those recommendations have been taken up and perhaps why they haven't been taken up. Because we may go for yet another review, almost reinventing the wheel again, and really report on similar recommendations which may not have been taken up. So I really would say we need to, in some way, consolidate all those recommendations and see to what extent those recommendations have been taken up. Because if you see some of the Public Service Amendment Act, for example, some recommendations have been taken up in terms of that act to tighten on certain issues like abscondment, etc., etc. So really, rather than having another new review take place, I really think we should recall those reviews that have happened and track those recommendations and assess what can be done with them and why they haven't been passed. Maybe there's practical reasons as to why they haven't been taken up. Because not only has the PSC done such reviews, but I also understand the DPSA has also done a review.
Thanks. Maybe what we'll have to note is that in the section of the report that deals with overview, we need to accommodate some of these developments. That it is true that the investigation here made some findings, but it's also true that there has been development. Like, for instance, the Public Service Amendment Act, which actually addresses also these issues. We may want to include a reference, a point under overview, so that we accommodate these things. I agree, colleagues. Okay. Before I volunteer, I see when people don't raise hands, you volunteer them. Raising on their behalf. All right, then we have dealt with the last and the fourth, ne? The last recommendation on dispute resolution and on review of disciplinary codes and so on. By the end of August, the PSC to report on progress with departmental implementation of its specific recommendation that came from the fourth consolidated monitoring evaluation. It's a straightforward thing. Is straightforward in terms of what is written there, but I'm not sure if it's straightforward in terms of a relevance to this section of you know.
Just in terms of process, I'm wondering if you shouldn't have a situation where you actually get a report from departments in relation to the progress they've done in relation to the PSC reports. We would then be in a position to then assess whether that has happened or not. But I think we should actually do it the other way around, where departments need, because we've given recommendations, they in possession of those recommendations, they need to then tell the committee to what extent they have acted on those recommendations.
And that will actually go a long way in terms of providing reasons why the Public Service Commission has to report to Parliament, and why reports of the PSC have to be referred to this portfolio committee. So I think if it means we do that through also conferring with other line portfolio committees, that is the in-house issue that we may want to deal with. But I think I had already put an amendment there to then say we need to follow up as a decision or a recommendation that the committee to follow up on the PSC's recommendations, all of them as indicated. Baba Maharaj.
Yes, Chairperson, that recommendation is actually contained in the second last bullet of this report here. And my only concern was, the practicalities in terms of how would departments be informed about this requirement. And obviously, would this portfolio committee communicate directly with the departments that sampled in this particular report so that they actually comply with your request? So it is contained in the second last bullet there in terms of the watch time. And then again, the DG saying that rather that than the third last bullet, and then we take it from there once we've received those communications from the various departments.
Chairperson, in terms of practicalities, I think we did recommend that the chairperson should actually write letters to members of the executive and the DGs of departments requesting those progress reports.
No, that's fine. It's actually on. She's quite right. That's how we're actually going to deal with that. It is actually one of the reasons that if we feel like you need the authority of Parliament, we may actually then indicate that those are some of the issues that we may then like sort of say write to submit a report to Parliament. Having considered this report by the Public Service Commission, we then say Parliament should actually address the following departments or on those issues. We may then be in a position to deal with that. Simply because of, you know, these issues of people call that TEF, others call it territory protection. So it sometimes becomes an issue. So. Okay. Thanks. Then we're done. Is there any other thing that's left? Remember somebody was saying that there are some of the issues, you're quite right, some of the issues that may not have been said. If we can remember, arising from both the minutes and memories.
Thanks, Chair. I think we also made a recommendation on the filling of vacancies. That the filling of vacancies should be prioritized and that they should be filled within the time frame of 90 days.
Yeah. You are quite right. Is there no penalty if, for instance, instead of taking 90 days, you have a department taking 240 days? Is there no remedy? Let me take out the word penalty maybe and substitute it with remedy. But you see, it will be that remedy that does not say, like, you know, when someone has done something wrong, those who are supposed to correct that person go there so apologetic and say, if it may be correct in your interpretation, to correct this thing, you know, that kind of an approach, it actually defeats us setting standards. We set standards, and those standards are meant to be complied. Is there no remedy existing now? And if there is any remedy, because the point she's raising there is fine. We have to do that. But you are still going to see, instead of 90 days, some departments, I'm not exaggerating, if you look in the report there, you will see some departments taking 900, or especially in the Eastern Cape. Now, I think in that specific case, on that section of the report, we will need to have a specific decision as a committee. A specific decision as a committee to then say, whereas we say filling of vacancies must be a priority by all departments, but we must actually investigate the reports, more especially in situations where the report is so bad. We will need to actually then say a targeted investigation. Actually, they need to explain as to what actually lead to those things. It may be that they will give reasons that we may accept, I'm not sure, but the fact of the matter is that you can't just let that section of the report just pass by like any other section of the report. It's not on.
Chair, I was going to really follow the line that you had started on, that you should actually have hearings on vacancies. You've got a fully fledged vacancy report which the PSC had brought out recently at the request of SCOPA. You're sitting with the fourth consolidated public service monitoring and evaluation report, which indicates where there are difficulties around the vacancy. And maybe when you then deal with those particular departments, you could then get explanations as to why those vacancies have not been filled. Because I think if you're just going to reinforce what is already a requirement in terms of the public service, that, you know, vacancies should be prioritized and filled within 90 days, it's really a reinforcement rather than a a visible action to try and understand why there's lack of movement, or at least to propel movement in this direction.
I think it's proper. We have our own team. We have, in terms of our program, two reports of the PSC on compliance with performance agreement. I think it's coming around what date is that is there in our program. I'm raising this thing that if we were to then say we need a hearing, targeted hearing, calling specific departments, we might want to actually look at this, so that when you do that, you also check, because you'll find that in those departments where you have departments not complying with the 90 days, they are way out. But when you look in terms of the performance assessment, you will have those people shining, the heads of those departments and officials there, given exceptional rating of performance. While on the other hand, you actually have situations like this. Maybe you might want to like sort of pull them together and actually deal with it as we deal with that. But it's correct. We need to call those departments and then have hearings. Let them explain, so that it's there in the report. And anyone who picks the report up, it's a public document. Without any explanation, we'll draw whatever conclusion that he or she has. But if we are in a position to also listen to, so that where there is a need for remedial action, we must be in a position. Corrective, I'm ending now. It's corrective action. I think corrective is slightly heavier than remedial. I think we might want to look at that. Do we agree? Sure, thanks. Any other thing that is in the report, or what we expect that should come in as part of addressing the question, so what? Like I've indicated, we have been raising this question. If Mr. Ulysses was here, he was going to be reminding us to say, no, I think the PSC should not always come and report to us. They have reported, and so what? We are addressing the so what now. Of course, it's a correct point that he raises. Member Tome.
So I think that the issue of recruitment was also raised. And maybe we should have a recommendation that departments should develop their own recruitment policies, of course, using the toolkit that has been prepared by the Public Service Commission as a guideline.
What about that? It is good we do that. We are recommending this thing. From here is enforcement by this portfolio committee. And when it is enforcement, we don't want excuses to say no, but this recommendation really it's not implementable, because we are not taking these decisions in the absence of people who are actually supposed to be dealing with these things. There is that proposal. Agreed? Thanks, agreed. Further points on the report, Member Tsongen?
Thanks, Chairperson. Another issue was that of risk assessment that was raised, and I think we made a recommendation that departments should put in place a risk management strategies in compliance with Public Finance Management Act and supplemented by the relevant treasury regulations.
Yeah, Chairperson, if you look at all your Auditor General reports and you look at matters of emphasis, the Auditor General also emphasizes this particular aspect of it. So I think together with SCOPA and yourselves, you need to determine how do you actually in the long run address this recurring problem about fraud prevention and risk assessment. Because it's a recurring problem. But it's, it's just a matter of going to most of your annual reports, you will see that's one of the particular areas that the Auditor General emphasizes on a regular basis.
Yeah, Chair, you know, I don't know whether we are talking in circles on these matters of recommendations, of things that are not done. For instance, the matter of selection policies in the departments. An issue on which, if I'm not mistaken, is actually a requirement in terms of the regulation that departments should have in place policies of selection. And as we have just said, in terms of the Public Finance Management Act, there is a legislated requirement that they should have in place risk management. Now, if we come round a recommendation saying that you should have risk management in place, we are going round the cycle now, because it is already there. You spoke earlier on, I'm not advocating that, you spoke earlier on in terms of should there be a penalty, but I don't know, one should really break away from the matter of recommendations and find something much more compulsive in terms of making departments do these things as required. Recollecting some of the previous discussions, I might have taken it out of context. I thought there was a process whereby on these recommendations like this, Speaker of the Assembly of Parliament has the facility to follow up, or in terms of sending to the executive, you know, requesting or demanding implementation of recommendations and things like that. I'm just trying to look here for something much more compulsive than saying it is recommended. People will still go around and not implement. Then you come back again. It is recommended that you put this in place. I don't know how many times one will do that, but it seems to me we need to find something much more compulsive than merely a recommendation that says, remember the last year recommendation, please do it.
I quite agree. Okay, fine. You're right.
I just wanted to say we agree fully with Prof. But what came out from the report is that departments do not comply. So I was hoping we'll be guided as to how do we ensure compliance.
Yeah. You see, a specific decision is that portfolio committees, this portfolio committee and our others call them sister committees, right? Should use or should give priority to ensuring compliance enforcement. That's what we need to do. We need to enforce compliance. If that happens through corrective measures, so be it. If that happens through penalties, also so be it. But correct compliance enforcement, actually, we need to comply with the rules, with the policies that we have actually set ourselves that we need to do. I think that is more the issue that we need to do. It's just that we did not succeed ourselves jointly, Portfolio Committee and Public Service Commission. You remember we wanted to, and the Department of Public Service, to visit departments, to do an inspection on service delivery improvement plans. I think it is through those targeted inspections that you may be able to actually pick up on some of these things, so that you then able to be in a position to suggest us what actually has to happen. There's quite a lot of things that we need to do. Compliance is the main issue that we might want to address.
Chairperson, I think the important part of this process is that the committee is raising the stakes in terms of accountability for implementation of the recommendations. So whilst in the past what we would say is that the commission is to make that recommendation, would present the report to the committee, we'll then go into another cycle of monitoring, and then we'll come back and say well, there is still no compliance. What I see happening here is that the committee is then converting this recommendation into actionable steps. And you're saying to departments that we expect you to have ABCD in place by such and such a day, and you are going to come back to us and say, I have done it or I have not done it, because if you have not done it, you're going to have to explain to us why you have not done it. And I think that's the important part of this process, that it's raising the stakes now in terms of accountability, that no more would a department have a situation where a finding will be made, another year goes by, and the same finding is made because they know nothing gets done, or even when they do not comply.
I think that's exactly what will happen. And I think people will take serious even an institution like our Public Service Commission. Because it must not be like, oh, they are coming. No, we know they'll come back again. No, it's business as usual. I think we're quite right. We need to move from recommendations to actions. And that's exactly what we are promising we're going to do. Fine, thanks. That then takes us to the end of this report, and thanks very much. We are going to clean here and there and have the report ready for signing. And then we process it further. The next item is the massified induction program by Palama. Is it Palama or Palma? Samdi.
Can I just ask a question? I mean, it's the first time I'm interacting with Palama now. Is it procedurally correct? I mean, because we haven't passed the bill as yet, or the president hasn't signed it. I mean, we're still going to debate this, so I just wanted to know in terms of procedure.
No, I think... Oh, I'm sorry, yeah, she's right. I'm not sure... You'll respond. Okay. Yes, well.
Thank you very much, Chair. Thanks, Honorable Member. The name Public Administration Leadership and Management Academy, Palama, is not, in fact, reflected in the act, in the bill. In the bill, they talk about the academy. They included it. So, because originally they said it will be known as an academy, it will be, they referred to it as an academy, and then a name to be decided sort of later. I see now if it's here, it was announced in the budget vote, but we haven't changed the look and feel of the academy. There are procedures which we are following in terms of working with GCIS to formalize the name, etc. Therefore, we are formally, even in our budget, I think we are still referred to as SAMDI. And it will only be known as Palama officially once all those compliance issues have been enacted and we have launched the name officially. Minister made an announcement in her budget vote speech, but we are still awaiting the official launch in August, and we hope by then all the compliance processes will be completed.
Thanks. It's fine. Let's not make a big issue. But the point that Dr. Rukma Rain is raising is fine. I was just checking as to whether we have the name of the institution called SAMDI defined now in terms of the act, or is just a name. No. SAMDI. It's just referred to, yeah. Shall have the. The name Samdi is not defined in terms of an X. It's a name. It's just like that. But of course, this mention is because this coincidence, you know, the announcement of the name and the and the submission of the bid. You know, that's what actually makes members to feel like concerned. It's fine. It's noted. You are South African Management Development Institute, SAMD, or Palama and stuff like that. The bill, when it becomes an act, will recognize your existence and will refer to you as you refer to yourself. But let's give you an opportunity now, like I've indicated, that this is a follow-up to our roundtable discussion on the massified induction program. And we sent out, we noted the issues raised by stakeholders. We sent those issues to SAMD and also to those stakeholders to then say if they want to raise some other things, they may be in a position to do that. But communicate directly with SAMD. Over to you. Colleagues, do we have copies of? Yeah, okay, fine. Over to you, SAMD.
Thank you very much, and thanks, honorable members. Yes, the report was circulated last week in terms of the agreement. And that particular report is not only the report, it's also, in, I think, three attachments to that particular report giving extra information regarding the mass induction program. Chair, I'm not going to use the PowerPoint presentation because we did the presentation at the round table. We're not going to repeat it. Therefore, maybe the assistant should not worry about setting it up. We included it as part of the package for information purposes. What we are going to do, Chair, through your permission, we'll, given the fact that we have tabled the report, we have circulated it, we'll highlight the key issues and responses which we worked on since the last round table. And I'll be sort of giving the broad context of our report, and then I'll let the program manager, Mr. Mukhalaji, to give the details in terms of the 8 points, which were the summary of the comments and questions and queries which were raised at the round table. Chair, I would like to start by indicating that our mass induction program is in fact a third generation course or program which was developed for the public service on induction and reorientation. The first generation was a program which was developed by the PCTA immediately after the decision of the cabinet on introduction of induction reorientation. After the first pilot or the pilot of that particular program, PCTA handed over the responsibility of that particular rollout of that particular program to SAMD, and what SAMD did, they took into account all the inputs which were made by the participants then and other stakeholders on the program. They improved the program, redeveloped it, and rolled it out as a second generation program. Therefore, we can regard the second generation rollout as a pre-massified induction program. And then in 2007, we embarked on another process where we re-looked at the program again and checked as whether it complied with some of the comments we received. We also consulted with a number of people or departments on this particular program, and we developed the third generation program, which we called MIP, Mass Induction Program, which excluded, as reflected or as indicated during the roundtable, the reorientation part of the cabinet decision. I must say, Chair, that when we responded to this particular to the issues raised at the roundtable, we had to go to our archives in terms of the records of consultation and some of the curriculum issues which you raised, and we also noted some of the partners or stakeholders who participated in the review of the curriculum. We also managed to contact some of the participants who were at the roundtable, obviously not all of them because of availability, and we came up with this report. Therefore, we are tabling this particular report, Chair, as our first attempt to provide a comprehensive overview of the mass induction program, but also noting the fact that we present this particular report not as a alpha and omega, but rather as our reaction, our initial reaction, taking note of the fact that we will have an opportunity of reflecting or implementing or rather effecting all the proposals which were made at the roundtable in our program as we implement it. it's our plan, or it has been in our plan, that we will review and improve this particular program within 18 months of its implementation. Therefore, we regard all our programs as living programs which are being reviewed at regular intervals, and mass induction is one of those programs. Chair, as part of the context in the report, we are also noting that mass induction program is one of the 60-odd programs which SAMHDA is providing to the public service. Therefore, it becomes important, given its nature and its cost-cutting element in terms of capacity building within the public service, where in every public servant, particularly in this particular one, all new public servants have to undergo the program. But it also became important for highlighting, given the fact that it was one of the first programs within SAMHDA which was subjected to the new strategy and to the new business model of the academy, where we are including all the partners, one in terms of curriculum development, but mainly in terms of rollout, where we are rolling out with other partners within the public service, including provincial academies, national departments, particularly the big ones, and over 500 individual trainers, which are spread all over the country. Therefore, Chair, we would like the committee to give us feedback on this particular report, and also guide us as to whether they accept this as a comprehensive report, or maybe they accept it as an initial step and they will want to mandate us to go and do further work. I would like to take this opportunity, Chair, to hand over to Mr. Mahalagi to take us through all the responses to the 8 points which you alerted us to. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Mutana, and thanks, Chair, honorable members, and everybody present. Chair, I'm going straight to the 8 issues as advised. The first one actually is about consultation processes that SAMHDA has undertaken previously with regards to the development of what today we know as the MIP, the Massified Induction Program. I will not repeat some of the issues that Mr. Mutlara has raised, excepting to say when the issue was raised at the roundtable, it came as sort of something that wanted somebody to clarify the steps that have been taken previously, and that is why the background information was necessary. But also equally important were some of the recommendations given in terms of mapping way forward regarding the future processes around consultation. Remember, Chair, that the whole question of the program review was mentioned. The reason why we are providing those faces in color on the bottom of page number 3 is to actually indicate that the consultation process is not over, despite the processes that have been initiated in the past regarding the pre-massified program and the current processes regarding the ones that led to the introduction of the MIP. Mr. Mugan has mentioned the issue of the 18 months review that will be happening. My arithmetic calculation says to me that will be around October of 2009, and that is about the time when we shall make sure that all participants and stakeholders with direct and indirect interest in the induction process are actually part of the review conference to take forward some of the issues that have been mentioned. So it is largely a process issue about the fact that we are committing ourselves to that review, and it is that review that will come up with brick and mortar and other details with regard to the enrichment of the induction program. Chair, I'm not sure, and I would like to be guided by yourself in terms of process, because I have sort of concluded speaking to point 2.1. I'm not sure whether I need to go straight to all the other remaining issues or wait for comment on 2.1.
Let's go straight.
Thank you. So in terms of number 2, the possible need for a broader definition of the MIP beyond Batubili, this came more as a question because I think an impression was created that because we have organized the content of the induction program under the belief set of we care, we serve, we belong, which is the Batubili belief set, that a perception was created that we were in this induction program only talking about the Batubili, but that was more organization of content. And as we unpack each belief under that, whether it's we belong or we care or we serve, you'll realize that there is a plethora of topical themes that are coming under each. In the presentation we have made, and I'm not sure if we are going to have time, we can actually revisit the PowerPoint presentation as it is available, just to indicate in terms of the content what areas are specifically covered under each set of the Batupili. So I think I'm making this point to emphasize the point that we are submitting, that the content of the induction program goes beyond simply the Batupili principles. And we have included other issues as well as other themes that were considered to be very important in building the ethos and understanding of the public servants from the point of view of the recruitment of new public servants. Chair, at the same time, we are saying, especially with regard to issues around the Constitution as it was raised by the Public Service Commission, the OPSC, that indeed we have attempted in the induction program to cover issues around the Constitution and the public service, but though not exhaustively. And this is because of some of the advice we got. If you look at some of the comments that were made by one reviewer on page number 4, that if we were to attempt to cover everything in the induction program, because you'd remember that it had two distinctive objectives. One would be to make sure that the incoming public servants do have a very fair knowledge and understanding of the public service, in other words, the key policies and programs. But quite importantly, number 2, and related to number 1, would be to instill that professional ethos and the Batupili orientation policies that we are talking about. So one reviewer actually stated that if we were to cover everything, we'd be a lot more ambitious. And in consideration of that, the review and the curriculum workshop that was referred to under 2.1 sought to actually rationalize on the content and come up with only those areas that we considered to be critical, at least in the initial implementation phase of the program, to be covered in this induction program. We are of the view that the review that's coming after 18 months, as was referred to, will also further guide that process in terms of fine-tuning both content and methodology moving forward. So I think a critical point we're making under 2.2, Chair, is the fact that we are aware that it is not covering all the things exhaustively, but perhaps it was not the intention of the induction program to do that. But if you again look at the products that we have as manuals, as workbooks, as well as what is referred to as reference materials there, we are alerting participants who are trainees in those 2 days of induction training about the importance of actually having to go further in terms of individual reading, to go and read some of the things that are referred to. And to that extent, we are providing some leads, whether they come in the form of web links or directly through mentioning documents that need to be read as a further process beyond the 2 days, Chair. In terms of issue number 3, that was broadening the scope of training to include the reorientation of serving public servants in line with the Cabinet's original mandate. Again, it came as a question about what we were doing with regard to the reorientation dimension for existing public servants. Chair, the reason why somebody focused on the induction of new entrance into the public service, in other words, the 100,000 that we are referring to as our target audience, and perhaps putting aside temporarily the whole question of the reorientation, is because we realized, one, that the capacity requirements for that 100,000 alone as a huge enterprise were quite immense, and it would require of us to do a reality check in terms of the capacity and the extent to which we could go with regard to that particular process. And I think the point that we are making and articulating very seriously is that the reorientation aspect is not abandoned. It is put in abeyance until all the requirements have been put in place, so that as soon as that has been achieved, then we can address those two particular questions almost running parallel. Another point that we must mention about the reorientation is that we are seeing it as part of the ongoing human resource and development strategy in terms of workplace preparations of our public servants. We are mindful of the fact that there are other initiatives by the DPSA, for example, that have to do with conscientizing and seeking to achieve the whole question of attitudinal reorientation of our existing public servants. And here one can mention programs such as the change management engagement, which is not necessarily offered to new public servants, but it's also unleashed to existing public servants. But we are saying broadly under the HRD strategy, we need to be looking at ways and means of ensuring that our serving public servants do not forget the ethos that we have articulated within the 1997 Batho-Pele White Paper. Chair, if I may come to issue number four, which is the criteria for the selection of training, of trainers, sorry, for the MIP, and whether the 8 days that we referred to in the meeting of the 21 May, the round table, was adequate. First, we are making a point that we sought to define criteria that would guide the selection of the trainers for the MIP. And this thing stemmed from the particular directive that we got from the minister to ensure that every person that was deployed to go and train on the induction program had to meet the criterion of a suitably qualified person. And to that particular angle, we sort of, in collaboration with provinces, met and came up with various criterions. And we elaborated the normal criteria, such as, for example, the understanding of the public service, you know, correct and proper qualifications in the area of training and development. And these were agreed to with the provinces in the main, and they became our selection criteria for trainers of the MIP in particular. Chair, the 8 days we submit is not enough to make sure that the kind of trainer we have for the MIP is the one that will make sure that common messages are articulated well and that the induction program is delivered coherently as we have envisaged. And to this end, we are making a point that, for example, in the new academy, we have set up a dedicated unit that will be responsible for ensuring continuing professional development of our trainers, whether these come in the form of associates that will be doing training on behalf of somebody. As you know, that one of the strategic thrusts of the academy has been that of moving away from providing direct training to ensuring that we facilitate and coordinate training. And to that extent, we have got into strategic partnerships with various entities. And that particular point is mentioned under the numerics on page number 5. Where we are talking about, for example, leveraging on the existing training capacity in the departments as well as the provinces themselves. That is point number 1 and 2, Roman figure 1 and 2. But 3, quite importantly, engaging the services of reputable providers from the private sector. And it is those providers that we also, Chair, subjected to that rigorous program of the 8 days that we spoke about, but as well as assessing whether they met the criteria that was outlined. So again, just for purpose of emphasis, the 8 days was used as something that would enable us to recruit the right people at the beginning of the process, but it remains our responsibility to ensure that as we continue with utilizing the services of those particular individuals, including trainers in departments and provinces, that we do give them the required development interventions. That will ensure that they remain as relevant and as people that can deliver on this course without problems. Moving over to page number 5, Chair, we are addressing the question of... it's page 6, sorry. Oh, point number 4, yeah. I'm still on the issue of criteria. My copy was mixed up. But something that I needed to mention also about the training of our trainers, whether these are departmental trainers or whether these are associates that come for outsourced training, we, as we explained in the roundtable meeting, We, in that 8-day program, sought to make sure that we come up with a very stringent sort of assessment tool that we used. And that table indicates what we were able to come up with. For example, it would indicate if we look at row number one, I will not do the same with the other rows, but just to explain so that the principle is understood correctly. If you look at 90 to 100, depending on, because we have an examination, we also assess these particular candidates who are trainers on understanding of content, on facilitation skills and so on. Somebody that emerges with a mark in the range of 90 to 100 is a person that could be almost regarded as our champion facilitator. Because that person will then be able to oscillate between the two levels of 1 to 5 and 6 to 12 with no assistant whatsoever. And it is these people, whether they are in the outsourcing category or in the departmental trainer category, that are going to be used in future to actually ensure that we train other trainers through their experience and skill. Going to 2.5 chair on page number 7, that question came from CETA in particular, but also from the Department of Communications, about what somebody was doing to leverage ICT to come up with something that could be referred to as e-induction and blended learning. Chair, we emphasized the point that we want to retain the SAMDI induction, the massified induction program, for now, at least in the beginning, as a blended learning approach, where we will make sure that we want to retain some of the value-laden topics, such as Batupili, the constitution for interactive classroom-based learning, whereas others that are more technical, like our budget allocations and so on, perhaps could be considered for online presentations. And we also made information of it. We also made a point that we are considering linking up with the Tshwane Metropolitan Municipality in terms of utilizing their narrowcasting facilities to deliver some of the learning areas in the induction program online. So that is what we will do, Chair, because the Academy is, in terms of good practices, committed and inclined to ensuring that our programs are not just delivered in a conventional and traditional way, but we will explore all other means that are there, like ICT, to make sure that we are able to reach the masses of our new entrant public service as we wish. Chair, 2.6 is flowing directly from the profound recommendation, so to speak, that was made by the OPSC regarding the fact that we should perhaps not be looking at just monitoring our training provision, but we should go beyond processes and actually look into things like what is the impact that we are having in terms of our induction program. Is it enhancing service delivery? Is it changing the attitudes of our public servants and so on? It is an area that somebody will learn. In collaboration with partners such as the OPSC as we move forward with the implementation of the induction program. And to that end, Chair, we are saying we are going to plan meetings between ourselves and the Office of the Public Service Commission to interrogate and correctly articulate the whole question of how we are going to come up with a results-based MNE, in particular for MIP, guided by the OPSC in this regard. The Chair was listening with keen interest when we were discussing around issues of compliance. By the way, the massified induction program is one of those programs that perhaps should belong to the basket of compulsories, to use that particular word, for lack of a better one, so that if we are taking up an initiative as this committee to assess the extent to which the departments are complying with either policy questions and other forms of regulations, that perhaps we should also consider, maybe being one of those, as it was put into effect through a ministerial directive, as we know, effective from the 1st of April 2008. Chair, 2.7, I'm not sure, because extensively this question was covered in the post-MIP presentation that was made to the Portfolio Committee, because it actually had to do with the broader academy strategy on massification rather than the induction program itself. What the MIP sought to do was to explain how we were delivering this program as a flagship program using the strategic thrusts of moving away from direct facilitation to coordination, moving away from competition to collaboration and so on. So I'm not so particularly sure whether we should also engage with this particular issue as an MIP question or whether we should integrate as we do so with a broader SAMDI strategy on massification. Because perhaps if we draw a distinction, that will ensure that we give full attention to all of them. But I'm aware that today's discussion is focusing on the MIP. So if I were to move, if I'm to move to point 2.8, which is our last point, the induction of, on page number 9, the induction of members of the SMS, the point that we are making, because again the question was asked, what was SAMDI doing? Because the 100,000 target audience we are referring to is actually our junior and middle managers, and not including members of the SMS. SAMDI is completely alive to the necessity of ensuring that the new entrants' SMSs also go through the process of induction, but we are also making a point about the Kaedu program, that we are also seeing as a managerial-type induction program for new entrant public services, public servants. And to that end, Chair, it is worth noting that some provinces already, like Free State and Mpumalanga, including departments such as the Department of Correctional Service, have these Kaedu programs as induction programs and compulsory programs. So the issue here is whether we need to subject our SMS to two distinctly different compulsory programs, as the trajectory has already been started by some provinces and some departments to make Kaedu become a compulsory program, or whether we should investigate the feasibility of including some of our typical induction learning areas into the Kaedu project. And to this end, perhaps we were thinking about talking to the providers of the Kaedu program to explore this feasibility, and instead of having two distinct induction programs in the form of Kaedu and perhaps the induction program for SMS, that we perhaps fuse the two to become one, not to have to subject our entrant SMS to similar training over time. So that is basically how we have approached the 8 issues as provided by the Portfolio Committee Chair. Mr. Mutlan has correctly pointed out that this is the first attempt at answering to the mandate as provided by the committee, and then we will be guided by the discussions that are going to ensue as to whether we need to be enriching this process further or whether we take this particular report as having answered the questions that have been raised. I thank you.
Thank you very much for the presentation. Before we ask questions, we make comments on this presentation, Inform Tea is ready. If you could take a break for about 10 minutes and then be back at 10 past 11, that would be super. Thanks. shall we proceed with our meeting? Palama Samdi, still double barrel. Palama Samdi has given us a presentation on the massified induction program. In fact, this presentation, as I've indicated, is a response to the 8 issues that we raised and we referred to them. We referred to them having noted that these are the issues that were raised at the round table. And we indicated in our letter addressed to Samdi that we may not claim that these 8 issues are exhaustive in terms of all the issues that were raised there. But it was like those issues that our record keeping managed to capture. We are saying this because the target audience in terms of Samdi's response in addressing these things firstly are the stakeholders that raise those issues. And then secondly, we then come in ourselves as a portfolio committee. That's why we advise that when Samdi deal with these issues, they should also interact with the stakeholders concerned and even check with them as to whether there are no other issues apart from the 8 that were raised. Now that Samdi has responded to the 8, it's an indication to us that it means having consulted those stakeholders, they confirm that these are the issues that they raise without any additions. And we note in the covering letter that Samdi has actually made an effort to interact with all the stakeholders. And it's indicated that some sort of clarity in some areas were like sort of arrived at, such that maybe some of the stakeholders that raise these issues may for now not feel like it is that necessary that we proceed engaging on the issues. The objective of this engagement today is for us as a portfolio committee to guide as to whether there is a need for further engagement on the issues as raised. Whether, I mean, on one-to-one base between Samdi and the institutions concerned, respectively. Or we want to then say there is a need for a follow-up roundtable to be able to deal with some of the issues as raised here. Now, let me then open this report for comments by members of the committee and the commission. The advantage is that those stakeholders that were part of the round table, we have 2 of them present here, the DPSA and the PSC. We didn't want to extend this to be a meeting of all those stakeholders that participated at the round table, because we like sort of anticipated that some of the issues as raised by those stakeholders in this engagement between Samdi and those stakeholders, you might find that some of the issues are actually addressed, such that you don't have to just call people to come here and say, yes, we agree. But then as to what then happens will be what will decide after engagement. And I want to call on members to come in, raise some issues if any. And then we take the process forward from there. If I may start, on page 4, the second issue, possible need for a broader definition of the massified induction program beyond what to build. the response is that it was not the intention of somebody to have a sort of limited approach guided by the what to believe policy. And the understanding was that when you unpack the set of beliefs under the four catchphrases, we care, we serve, we belong, you'll find that you end up in a situation where the scope is so broadened that you're not only talking about Watupili, but you're talking about all possible policy guidelines or policy positions that we have. Now, if I may ask as to whether during the interaction there is any stakeholder that identified any other key component factor that is missing when you try to clarify in terms of the all-inclusive situation through the we care, we belong, we serve belief sets. Is there any institution that then said, no, we feel like you should have actually considered 1, 2, 3? And if yes, what are those things that they might have actually addressed? Point 4, that's page 5. On the criteria for selection of trainers, the other question that was raised there, I can't remember which stakeholder raised this issue, but the other question that was raised was, what is the role of policy makers in identifying trainers? And you remember that was actually linking to the outsourcing question. To then say, how do we assess these trainers? I noted you actually referred to reputable providers of service. But if you say reputable, the issue is, what are the indicators? If we're to unpack, if we're to unpack that, more especially where you're talking about training for public servants and stuff like that, how do we assess the merits of the trainers that we end up involving, and what is the role? The main concern there was that. What actually is the role of policymakers? I remember one participant saying, you see, you will have, he said, no, I see a list of very conservative trainers, you know, coming on board, but what is actually the criteria, more especially in terms of who then deals with the selection and stuff like that. I think that those are some of the issues that we might want to reflect on as we deal with these issues. That was my first comment. Some few questions there. Colleagues, is there any other point you want to raise on this issue? Sure, thanks. Baba Gawaza, and
Chair, I don't know whether I missed it when we first discussed this a couple of weeks ago and today. I just wanted to check, Chair, whether once a trainee has completed the training, there is a way of acknowledging that this person has gone through training and has achieved a particular level of, satisfactory understanding of the workings of the department. some kind of certification which would serve as an incentive for people to attend and give it their best shot. Something that could, you know, in later years when people want to migrate to other pastures that might look greener, and hopefully the department is going to be greener every time, so they won't have to. But supposing they want to, you know, is there something that they can take out and say, we have been in the public service and this is how far we have achieved, and so on.
Thank you very much. Do we have further comments, Mr. Gore?
Thank you, Chair. I'd just like to put my formal apology to the committee and to the stakeholders here today for being late. I do apologise. I have two questions, and perhaps the first question, I'll take some guidance from you, Chair, as to whether it is appropriate to ask the question. As a person with a disability, I think it's vitally important that the Public Service Administration instills a process of inclusion that includes employment of people with disabilities, as well as ensuring that people with disabilities as clients to the public service are correctly contained. And perhaps some guidance from you, Chair, whether this is an appropriate question, whether the orientation within the mass induction program has been taken into account, whether there has been sensitization programs planned for the public service, particularly around principles of Batapele. That's the first question. The second question is around the e-learning. If perhaps, you know, reading into the report, I see one of the biggest problems is how do we, you know, roll out this program to 100,000 new entrants into the public service every year. Obviously, and I agree with the comment made in the report that it's face-to-face interactions are best. I think the other suggestion of outsourcing is a good one. But I do believe that e-learning should be considered. So perhaps we could get some feedback from the stakeholders as to what are they considering, apart from the two points raised in the technology part of the report. I know, for example, that other countries, particularly in education, have achieved a lot in skills and training by using online certification and interaction. I know it's not the panacea for skills transfer and skills for skills training, but in terms of the challenge of rolling it out to 100,000 public service servants, this might be an opportunity to explore. Thank you, Chair.
No, thanks. Those are relevant questions. Even the first one is verified. Ma'am, Chet.
You'll forgive me. I'm a new member here. I forgot to tell you.
Yes.
You see, while we were presenting, I was wondering in mind, saying, do we have a policy? Because I know that once you train people, there is money involved, and you equip that person and empower. How sure are we, after training, that this person is not going to leave the country and go to other countries? Do you have something that is actually saying, after training, you can't leave the country? Because we've got this problem of skilled people leaving the country after a lot of money has been used to empower them. Thank you.
Skills exodus. Any further question? Ma'am Atomer.
Chairperson, I'm sorry because I've been reluctant to ask this question because I think I asked the last time. Now I've forgotten what the answer
is.
Please, I would like to
keep a reminder.
Yes. Thanks, Chairperson. Thanks for understanding. We are saying when we were planning for this massification of induction, we looked at the numbers, and we're saying we are moving from 3,000 to 100,000. I just want to know as to why this increase. Are we anticipating an increased number of people who will be joining the public service, or are we saying we want to also introduce this program to those who are already in this? And if I could get that answer, Chairperson, it will lead me to my next one. Thanks, Chair.
No, thanks. Maybe before we go to the next one, after your response, just some few additions. You are saying that the reorientation part is not abandoned. It's an interesting statement. It's not abandoned, yes, fine. But is there a program? Is there a program to see us rolling our sleeves towards that direction? More so, you will find that we may sometimes say reorientation may not be an issue. But if you look at e-induction, for instance, you will find that it becomes a critical issue as we talk of e-government and stuff like that to take those things on board. Consultation, you are saying you have consulted widely. Widely. So you involved almost all. I'm not sure if you were able to say to the stakeholders that raised these issues, because the stakeholders that raised these issues during the round table are those who believe that they are part of the extended family of public service. So if you consult widely, the issue is where did you start? Did you start at home, or the sort of charity that begins somewhere? Are we able to see in your list of those you consulted widely the inclusion of the stakeholders that actually formed part of that roundtable? Like I've said, the selection for participation at the round table was very careful. To then say you are actually talking about those who are like sort of key in public service. Now, if they raise this issue, and the answer is that there was a wider consultation, something is missing there. And what is it that is missing? So that we then assist us to take the process forward. For now, maybe let's have responses to those comments and questions. We'll take the second round if there's any other thing.
Thank you very much, Chair and honorable members. I noted 9 questions, if I'm correct. We'll try to respond to all of them. I'll handle about 4, and then I'll leave the rest to Mr. Mukhalaji. May I need to start with the last one, or start with Ms. Honorable Matumela's question about the planning part of it. Yes, you are correct, ma'am. We are talking about the previously covered public servants were about 3,000, and now we are planning or intending to cover 100,000. The 3,000 which you are referring to them, ma'am, refers to that those public servants who were trained on the second generation induction program. It was not compulsory, it was optional, and departments decided whether they wanted it or not. And it was open to all public servants, both the saving public servants and the new public servants. And in 1 year, we could only train 3,000 public servants. And when we planned, we started to say that let's take into account the numbers. We looked at the total number of public servants, we looked at the participation by DPS, and also the total number of new recruits every year. And we realized that it's a big elephant. And we won't afford it, given the fact that we are still establishing ourselves as an academy. We need to put systems in place. We need to develop programs. And it was decided at the management team, also after consulting with the minister, that maybe it would be wise for us to segregate the two groups. the saving public servants who are already have gone through their probation and their permanent employees, and those new ones, to say maybe it will be wiser to start with this smaller group, which is 100,000 new public servants which are recruiting every year. And that's where the 100,000 come from, as opposed to 3,000 which you trained previously on both the new and the current saving, which shows the discrepancy between the magnitude of the task ahead of us. To say previously, the pre-massified one, was there was no ministerial directive, there was no massification kind of plans and systems and interactive workbooks. We could only do 3,000. And if we could have continued on that particular basis, it would have taken us maybe, I don't know how many decades, to cover all public service. Hence, this new approach. And I think that particular question links up with the chair's question about the fact that we haven't abandoned the reorientation part of the cabinet mandate. Yes, we haven't abandoned it. We just segregated the orientation for new recruits first, as we plan for the reorientation. But we also say in the report that the reorientation won't just be a training program. Because we are arguing, and as it was argued at the round table, changing mindset and changing the public service is not only about training. It's a whole comprehensive and integrated approach to changing the culture of the public service. And we are taking our cues from the human resource development strategy, and also noting that we need to work with DPSA in ensuring that we reorientate these public servants. Some, obviously, when it comes to that particular stage, will come in through a training program, but it has to be part of the holistic approach to changing the culture of the public service. Maybe I also want to go to the beginning, take that question about the chair, the page 5 on the selection of trainers, and as whether policymakers are involved or were involved in terms of the selection of those trainers. I want to premise my response to this particular question by saying that, first of all, we need to acknowledge the fact that these trainers are not all coming from the private sector. The bulk of the trainers, I don't know the percentage, so Hala can give me the percentage, but it's definitely more than 60% of these trainers are located within the public sector. Some are located in provincial academies, in province or training units. Others are located in departments, training units like regional services, SAPS, defense. They've got huge training units with trainers. All those trainers which are in government are being trained through the TOT program to be ready to offer the mass induction program. Therefore, they are public servants, but they are just being prepared to be able to offer this particular program. But yes, you are correct. Some of the trainers which we subject to TOT come from the private sector as individuals. And the process which we are following in selecting these particular trainers is akin to recruiting a public servant. First of all, they apply. They are subjected to an interview process where we rate them and score them on particular given by criteria. After that, the ones who are successful and now go to the second phase. The second phase involves the TOT. The TOT is not only the preparation for them to be able to train, but it's also a selection tool. They are being subjected to that particular program and they are being assessed formatively and summatively in that particular program as to whether they are ready to be facilitators of this particular program. Therefore, these are people who we are selecting, sort of handpicking them, like as if we are selecting a person for a permanent position. Therefore, it's not like in the past, previously, two, 3 years ago, issue a tender to say there's a training program, we need service providers to offer this particular program, tenders will come in, we'll evaluate the tenders, and the organization which won the tender will train. We wouldn't have any control on ultimately the person who stands in front of the particular group of public servants. Now in this particular case, through this particular process, we can be in a position to know that this particular facilitator was interviewed, trained, and selected, and checked through our systems. Therefore, that's as far as the trainers are concerned. But to respond to your question directly, Chair, in selecting the trainers, yes, there was no involvement of policymakers. I think we made reference to involvement of policymakers when we were talking about the curriculum framework, especially the second generation one. When we were working on it, which informed the third generation, yes, policymakers were included, specifically BPSA. But in terms of selecting trainers, we saw it as our responsibility. But I don't see any problem in the future for us if BPSA, probably the HRD branch, is available to assist us in that regard. Yeah, maybe I need to pause here and give me some Halay a chance to talk about certification and considerations regarding issues raised by Honorable and other questions.
Thank you, Mr. Mutlana. Perhaps just to start with the issue that was raised by Mama Zumela, again, without repeating what Mr. Mutlana said. The justification for the 100,000 stems from the 10% turnover rate in the public service on an annual basis. 90% is actually those that are in the band of junior and middle managers, and only 10% will be our SMS, talking about the new entrants. So if we take the 100,000 and actually disaggregate it further, and the numbers could change, because that was used for planning purposes. But this is the percentage that we are all working on when we want to establish the numbers commensurate with the turnover rate percentage. So it's actually 10% annually of people that leave the public, and therefore those that join would be the equivalent number of those that were leaving. So it helps to justify the 100,000 that we are using. And again, the point to make about this number is actually the mandate that says we needed to enroll new public servants to scale. In other words, the mass induction, as the word says. So everybody that joins had to be inducted within a period of 6 months after their date of appointment. So that's a particular challenge that's related to that particular number. Chair, you raised the question about whether in the consultation processes there were instances where we could discover that perhaps some of the issues that were raised were not covered in terms of the curriculum or the content of the induction program. The only input relating to inclusion of a particular content for the induction program, at least from the point of view of the roundtable meeting on the 21st of August, was the one that was mentioned by the DG OPSC around the need to focus to a certain extent quite extensively on the Chapter 10 principles of the Constitution. And the point that I sought to make earlier was around the fact that, yes, we acknowledge that perhaps in the current phase it's not as amplified as perhaps the OPSC would like to have it, but we are committed to a further dialogue with the OPSC in terms of enriching that part of the induction program that speaks to the Constitution or the constitutional principle. At the moment, we have it as the Constitution and the public service. And we make, yes, casual reference to some of those principles that underpin the public service, but not extensively. The review that we are talking about is actually a review where the constituent departments of public service administration are going to be key in terms of first defining what the content of the review would have to be and the decisions that will emanate from that process. Because we anticipate that once that has been accomplished, we'll then emerge with a new induction product away from the one that we have currently. So as far as we remember, that was the issue that was mentioned in terms of how do you enrich the content of the induction. Prior to that, we also, just for purpose of information, Chair, consulted with the Committee on Public Service and Administration. That was in relation to the past presentations that we were meant to make. You'll recall that we had extensively Yeah, we were intended to come and make presentations, but for some reasons, a number of the planned meetings with the committee were sort of postponed. One of the issues that was asked by the committee, at least on the point of view of the research unit of the Public Service Committee, was the inclusion of the sexual harassment, because we were told that it was an issue and it would be worthwhile for somebody to consider including that particular aspect in the induction program. And again, if we were to unpack that we care, we serve, we belong, we would see that it's strongly featured there, without pretending that we could offer it from A to Z, but at least we make some key pertinent references to that whole question around sexual harassment. So I'm saying those that we were at least able to get from so-called external parties with regard to the curriculum process were the OPSC, at least for now in terms of the constitution, but previously we had some ideas around other matters such as the one that I've just mentioned. Chair, you asked whether there was a program in place for the reorientation. Again, we are alive to the importance of making sure that we do have a program in place for this particular one. We would also, I referred earlier to the need to integrate some of the reorientation initiatives that are there. It is not only going to be, as Rufus was pointing out, training, but training together with other initiatives. And some of them, as I indicated, come from the DPSA itself, but others will have to come from, in a nuanced fashion, from what the HRD strategy is saying about continual professional or skill development program, so to speak, for our public servants. So it's a matter that we are committing ourselves to addressing as the process unfolds, and we will definitely develop a program to answer to this particular one. But if it has to be only from the point of view of training, somebody will undertake that initiative and make sure that we do have a program as requested. There was a question from the Honourable Member relating to the certification for learning after the two-day induction program. Yes, like all the other programs that somebody offers, we do offer a certificate. This is not a certificate of competence. It is a certificate of attendance, because this is a generic induction program that is not offered as a skills program. In other words, we don't put some NQF, National Qualifications Framework, credits there out of consideration that some of the learning areas do not necessarily have unit standards against them. Some may have, but those that have will be referred to, and there would be standalone courses that would be offered by the academy and addressing those in full. But for the induction program, only a certificate of attendance is the one that is being issued out. Said that your point, Mr. Goh, around the disability inclusion, it's a point that we are noting as the academy. It's a point that must also inform our review of this induction program, and we will make sure that it is fully covered. Around the question of e-learning, we are committed to also exploring this particular facility, e-learning, for the reorientation program. And that is the last statement we are mentioning under leveraging ICT as an option to massification of the induction program. So clearly we will do that, because with time you will realize that some of the serving public servants would want to be inducted at the comfort of their own homes, at the comfort of their own pace in terms of learning, and we have to make use of ICT to ensure that reality is achieved. Ma'am, there was a question you asked about how do we make sure that those that we have trained do not leave, and I'm sure that question was related more to skills program, that would have to make sure that people have technical competencies. With induction, we are not necessarily looking for that, and we wouldn't be therefore in a position to sort of hold back on the people we have trained to make sure that they do not leave. It's a program that will remain relevant for public servants for as long as they move within the public service, such that somebody who has been trained or inducted in the Eastern Cape, for example, need not be inducted when that particular person moves from Eastern Cape, say, to Limpopo. All right, so it remains relevant. And for that,
only for the weather.
Yeah. And Chair, there was the whole question of the wider consultation. Yes, we have sought to extensively answer that question in the first issue under consultation, but consultation is never enough. So we will continue to consult as and when it becomes necessary, but we have heard your point around the need to emphasize consultation with policymakers. That was done to a certain extent with regard to the pre-massified induction program. We made reference to the learning framework that sort of gave birth to the induction program of the previous. And that was always a joint process between ourselves and the DPSA. In fact, again, if we check on the program of action, you will realize that the induction program is, although led by SAMDI, but another key partner that is supporting this process is the Department of Public Service and Administration. So when we did road shows on the learning framework, these were done jointly by SAMDI and the DPSA. Thank you.
Chair, may I would like to add as a last comment to say that the consultations which we embarked on started immediately after the roundtable. I remember one of the first person to be consulted after the roundtable was the commissioner commissioner from the DSECO. The DG had a long discussion with him in terms of informing this kind of report. And I know there was also discussions with the DPC, in particular my colleague Cornet, I think she was supposed to be there. Therefore, some of the consultations may not have been in writing, but they were telephonic or they were one-to-one. But as my colleague indicated, these consultations are never an end in itself. We see it as a continuous process, and we would like to say that as this report has been now circulated to all the participants of the roundtable, we are expecting some response again to the report now, not only to the questions, but to the report to say this report is lacking there or is sufficient here, etc. Therefore, there may be other inputs which may be in our email which are coming on the basis of this particular report we are taking to.
Thank you. Mayor Matomela, Mr. Kwawaza.
Thank you, Chair. Thanks very much. My question has been well answered. Now I remember that it was the last time. Chairperson, I believe that the major objective of us having something and for us restructuring it the way we are doing is to basically and at the end of the day improve service delivery on the ground. Yes, getting qualifications is one thing, ensuring that people understand what they're supposed to do and they implement it's fine. But our major challenge as a family of public service and administration is to ensure that there is service delivery on the ground and to continuously improve service delivery. Now, Chairperson, I want to go back to the issue of reorientation. With induction, we are introducing people to the public service, saying this is what we're supposed to do, this is what is expected of us according to the Bakbili principles, etc. But now, how do we get these people to do what they are supposed to do? And for me, that's where we need strong leadership. People who will ensure that the people do what they are supposed to do. They do it correctly, they do it willingly, and they do it enthusiastically. So to me, Chairperson, reorientation is what we should put more emphasis on. Because if we concentrate more on the people who are just coming in, these people, I suppose they are enthusiastic already. I mean, getting a job, getting a new job, some of them have wanted to work for the public service for a long time. Finally, they are there. I take it normally they would be enthusiastic, but they find me, Chairperson, who is supposed to be the answer, who has been there, who is doing business not even as usual. Who's just there because I'm employed and I'm getting paid at the end of the month. So, Chairperson, I'm sorry that I'm taking us on a round table mode, but I think it's important.
No, it's fine. You debate. That's what this meeting is meant for.
The issue of the responsibility of the department has been mentioned, that somebody has got to work with the DPSA. And for me, DPSA's role mainly is to ensure that they create an environment that will ensure that people do what they're supposed to do and they do it well. And then we have got somebody then on the other side to give the qualifications. I think what we need to apply our minds on, Chairperson, is now as somebody, what role are we playing in ensuring that service delivery takes place? I know it has got to be done in conjunction with the DPSA, but leadership, Chairperson, I think in the not so distant past, we had a presentation about management in the public service, and some of us actually asked that, do we really have managers in the public service after the report that we received? And to me, that's the major challenge. We've got people are qualified, they've got the certificates, but people are not doing what they're supposed to do. And that's where the gap is. So I'm just putting this challenge to somebody, Chairperson. I don't know if there is much that they can do about it, but to me it's very important. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mayman Tomela. Mr. Gowas.
Yeah, Chair, I just want to check whether the program group does also respond to skills gaps that would have been identified in the process of evaluating performance, especially maybe senior management, or would some leave that to the specific to the departments, because those would be more specific to the on-the-job kind of work. I do want to think aloud, Chair. Probably e-learning is part of the answer to the question I'm asking. Like you were saying, someone would want to, you know,
also want to combine your question and over and above the induction program, some is also offering sort of a myriad of programs, such as one for your schools and one of the chief priorities, and that's how we distinguish ourselves from the schools, is to ensure that our program has our participants and what they're supposed to do. Therefore, the induction is about people with the bigger issues and general aspects of our program used to in on rather on specific skills which are required in the five fields, and we put it in the report as annexure A, and we classify those programs. And this is a sample: some are on leadership, others on managing finances, others on particular delivery improvement, some on managing people, and lastly, good governance, which obviously we'll be happy about. Therefore, we see orientation as an important one, but we are also rolling out this orientation induction program together with other programs on various skills and different functions, like issues of people management, issues of management and leadership, etc. Therefore, what we are appealing to honorable members is to look at some induction program, the 100,000. As one of the many other programs we have in the country. Remember that induction has been 100,000 times. If we have to work at target for all the other programs, we will be arriving at a significant number, which will be a massive engagement for an organization which, of the subs. Obviously, when we move into the academy and we fill all the positions, we will be able to with the challenges. That's a broad answer, Chair. My colleague Mkhaladi will be more specific in terms of the second question.
Chair, the question that was raised by Honorable Mr. Meli on the inclusion of local government, we have already begun discussions with the Department of Provincial and Local Government, which is responsible for Lokola. That local government leadership academy, investigating how we are going to work together.
We call it Lokola.
Lokola.
Oh, okay.
Local government leadership academy. We have, it's a triumvirate. It's involving the Department of Provincial and Local Government from the point of view of Lokola, but also we have started discussions with LG CETA, local government CETA. It turns out that we will have to work together in that particular direction, because for the induction program to be offered at municipalities and so on, it will also have to have the blessings and the accreditation by the local government CETA. So we have started discussions around those particular questions, and there is some evidence of initial endorsement to that particular process. What we have done in the interim was to issue out the induction manuals to all these parties for them to look at whether we have covered or we have to cover some of the content that pertains to local government issues. I must hasten to mention that in the current form, we do have something covering categories of municipalities, what their roles and responsibilities are in terms of the whole area around intergovernmental relations. And we are not pretending to be exhaustive in terms of that area, and that is the reason why we are also consulting. And this consultation that has to do with, for example, the future curriculum around including local government as part of this process. Because we still want to retain it as a single induction program under the auspices of the single public service. Suffice to mention that we have already started discussions in that area.
Thank you very much, Chair. Maybe just to the last point on the local government, we gained a lot of experience on local government also. But if members remember, over the past 2 years, we've been engaging local government, municipalities, and municipal entities on supply chain management training. And we successfully managed to cover all 283 municipalities and municipal entities, their supply chain staff, train them on all those supply chain processes and procedures. Therefore, that particular program gives us some kind of confidence that we will be able to enter that market with this particular program on induction, on some backups and capacity. Thanks.
Thank you very much. I see two hands more. It's fine. Let me add one question. Maybe we'll have this as the last round, the third round, and then as you do follow up on the questions that have been raised and answered, you can also respond to this other. During the roundtable engagement, you introduced a two-volume manual on MIP. The first volume targeting several levels or cost levels 1 to 5, then second one 6 to 12, but you see 13, I'm not sure the senior management service if you actually have a different one. And if my memory serves me well, you indicated that what is being rolled out now is the volume that is with 1 to 5 years, up to 12. Okay, no, it's fine. So it's fine. If that's my correction, though. So it's fine. Your senior management is included in the whole thing. It's not. Can you comment on that one? Because your target of the total figure include 68 and 32, ne? And that takes us to where's your presentation here? The very, very first. New public servants at national and provincial, say 100,000 per annum, ne? 68 levels 1 to 5, and 32, 6 to 12, or 68 and 32 takes you to the 100,000. So the SMS is something like maybe it's 1,000. So you got a different program. Okay, fine. Thanks. Those two hands that were up to respond to the last, are the last bites. Yeah.
Oh, thanks, Chairperson. I see there on point number 2.8, where we're discussing a Kaedu program, that is saying there may be need to have additional time to concentrate on the MIP level for the SMSs. So it's just a recommendation or a comment, Chairperson, that I think we may want to consider including in these 2 days, or even maybe increasing that with another day, you know, something that will motivate the leadership, because these people are the ones who are leading. Yeah? So let's also, besides, you know, teaching them or engaging them on what they're supposed to do, try to get some life into these leaders. Because if the leaders are dead, then our public service will be dead. You know, a way of, and which should be continuous. I really believe that leadership plays a very important role in making sure that people get to do what they are supposed to do. So if we can have something like on an ongoing basis to get our people, you know, to serve us with love, to serve us because they want to do it, not what we see happening in the public service now. Thanks, Chairperson.
Oh, thank you very much, Mr. Matomela. Before the follow-ups in terms of response, I want to recognize the presence of Colette Clark somewhere there. We received a report that says on the consultation issue that there has been wider consultation in developing the massified induction program. And why I'm raising this thing is that, yes, we received your apology that you join us late. But your role there, because if we raised an issue of wider consultation, but why do we still have questions on consultation? I think you will also assist there. The point came from the department during the roundtable, and particularly from the area that falls squarely under your leadership. Okay, let's have those further responses. Chief, no, there were two hands up. Yeah, let me recognize them first.
Yes. No, my question has been covered in terms of the SMS inclusion in this process to provide leadership and in terms of the leadership committee as a framework. So it's been covered, and I'm sure my colleagues will be able to address issues that I was going to ask.
Thank you very much. Commissioner Maras?
I probably share the same passion that Honorable Masmala has around orientation, especially around senior management. Before I get to that, I just want to acknowledge somebody's, addressing some of the issues that were raised, or most of the issues, and comprehensive issues, for giving us copies of that. And thank you very much to somebody for doing that. The orientation program, and they mentioned the word elephant earlier on, is a matter of concern generally, and I think they need to just take note of that. It's a worry. And to what extent they could actually just make it a part of the, deliberate part of the Kaedu program as well around the SMSs, to just have a look at Kaedu, see to what extent there's some form of orientation around Kaedu. So when people do come back, they come back with a different mindset, they come back with a different attitude. That will be very, very useful. But the danger is that you induct so many people and they're coming into an environment that is not conducive to service delivery, and they learn the bad habits of the existing public service. That is the danger, and we are all worried about it. Around orientation, you're not going to be able to know. We share the sympathy, and I sympathize with somebody around having to reorientate a million public servants. But I certainly would want to believe that there are some public servants who, in fact, just expose themselves for reorientation. The ones who've been found guilty of misconduct, for example, short of dismissal, must be made to attend the compulsory reorientation program of some kind, around the code of conduct, or whatever the case might be. People who show certain trends in terms of work ethic, absenteeism, or whatever the case might be. So you begin to take out the not the rotten ones, but some of the people who are beginning to show so bad apple tendencies, to begin to say that there's a program that they will and make some recommendations around at least submitting those kinds of people to a form of reorientation. I think that's a particular way of actually running this in parallel with your induction program. But certainly induction program is necessary as part of any good employer processes in terms of recruitment. But the concern has been around why is it the public service is not performing to the level and with the kind of passion and compassion that it's meant to perform. So the orientation is indeed for us an area of worry.
Thank you very much. We are about to close. Is there any other further comment? When we summarize, I'll give my comment and give some the opportunity to have closing remarks. And Prof, if there is any point you want to make also, we will definitely do that. But on the presentation and on the discussion on MIP, is there any other particular input? I think we are noting that on consultation, which is a topical issue, we are noting that there is this 18-month review that you referred to. I'm not sure if it's a once-off thing, it's ongoing every 18 months. And the next one is due in October 2009, which stakeholders may take advantage of to further enrich the induction program. Is there any other thing that yes?
What doesn't come out clearly for me is the funding model that is going to be used in order to get the processes going. In the report, I've tried to look for strategies to fund the processes, but it doesn't come out clearly. And I would love that be attended to and clear indication and guidance to departments as to how this should be funded, should be provided.
Good morning to you all. I think picking up from the robust debate that we had in the round table, to the follow through, one of the things which we need to share, which would be an answer to some of the concerns that have been raised, is the draft leadership development strategic framework for the senior management service. Clearly focuses on the training and development expectations within line departments, which deals with compulsory training and compulsory induction. But the issue that we addressed, I think it's linked to the funding, which we'd have to deal with the reconciliation, and clearly it also impacts on the consultation, is the contradictions in terms of where the mandates lie with regards to the Skills Development Act, which is an act under the purview of the Department of Labor, which specifically indicates that each employer will determine their own skills needs and therefore come up with a workplace skills plan and how they're going to be spending the 1% that they've set aside. And it touches on the funding model in the sense that if they have the authority to do that, and in the consultation process, we are indicating that they need to set money aside for compulsory induction, how do we get them to buy in relation, to how they are reprioritizing their workplace skills plan for scarce skills? Because there's also, if you go into specific sectors where the focus is on core business induction for nurses, for teachers, and not generic induction in terms of a generic induction program, and they've set that aside for induction for curriculum or induction for on-site training. How does one reconcile the priorities in the consultation process? And clearly, that is a challenge as we are trying to roll out the human resources development strategy, which Cabinet has approved, in that we've given a generic implementation plan to line departments to say, identify your capacity building programs, and how do we reconcile what we want in. Now, coming back to the senior management service, what we are saying with the draft strategic framework is there would be issues that lend themselves to policy decisions that clearly will have to be taken to Cabinet. And one of them that has been mooted is a compulsory period of training, example, 80 hours for senior managers on an annual basis, in the same way that you've got the CAIDO. Now, for us, it's a matter of how do you take what's in policy and then implement it and reconcile it, in terms of the training programs that, that exist. And we'll have to have much longer conversations, and the Commission has agreed to facilitate such a conversation, between ourselves and SAMD to get the ball rolling in relation to the gaps that they've identified that have been raised around the table, specifically targeting senior managers, with regards to their capacity and competency. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Any comment? Somebody?
Thanks, Chair. I take it that Ms. Clark's question, elaboration on the Strategic Leadership and Management Development Framework would answer the questions that related to the SMS induction, so I'll leave that out. The whole question of the funding model, again, I think it was touched on a little bit. We are aware that DPSA is also engaged in, for example, for lack of a better word, unlocking the utilization of that 1% by department. So it's a process that is already been started. From the point of view of what the DPSA, in terms of the advocacy role about MIP, has done with the release of the directive was to clearly articulate in the accompanying letter to the directive the fact that departments are responsible and management in departments is responsible for making sure that there are both processes, systems, as well as budgets made available for the implementation of MIP. And that MIP becomes part of the professional development of employees and so on. It's an issue that, in the light of the discussions we had around compliance and monitoring, that we must also look at. As one hinted to perhaps the possibility of including the MIP as one of the compulsories within those that need to be looked at, moving forward to check and assess levels of compliance by departments. So I think the question was answered in terms of SMS and the funding model, I think, yes, to a certain extent. And yes, we will be guided by what the findings are and recommendations that are coming from this project that DPSA is undertaking.
As closing remarks, Chair, as you requested, maybe one could say that from some side, we are sort of, we appreciate the engagement, the rich engagement and interest which has been shown by members in this particular, for this particular program, and in fact illustrate the importance of induction and reorientation in the public sense. And I think for us, it's also reminding us not to be complacent as we roll out this particular program, but to be aware that this particular program is one of the many other keys which are important in unlocking service delivery. And we will continue, Chair, to engage other partners in implementing the program, but also in planning for the next review of the program, particularly the MME part, which we mentioned in the report, which we need to start working on with the PSC. But I must say, Chair, as a general comment and closing sentence, to say that this particular engagement did not only inform our sort of processes and systems in terms of MIP only. It also overflows to other programs, and we will take these as some kind of enriching contributions to the improvement of our programs. Thanks.
Thank you very much. That now brings us to the end of discussions on this item of the massified induction program. As the objective of this engagement was to assess as to what then is the way forward emanating from this discussion, which is actually informed by what transpired at the round table and further engagements between SAMDI and the relevant stakeholders. My view is that it's a submission that the committee will have to consider to say that the response by SAMDI as presented at this meeting today assists us to draw the following conclusions. One is that the rollout of the massive induction program in the public service by SAMDI is a product of a wider stakeholder consultation, but also noting that a consultation on itself is actually ongoing. You don't reach a stage where you say you have actually exhausted the process of consultation. but what is assisting us to move forward in terms of what we propose to adopt is that in the consultation program or mechanism by some deed, there is a built-in arrangement of a continuous review, which then is a window open for continuous influence, assistance, enrichment of the program itself. And we also note that there may be a need by other stakeholders to still want to have an opportunity to influence the program, which stakeholders will find an opportunity through this review mechanism that is there in terms of the program itself. And of course, in as far as other issues are raised in terms of all the 8 issues, we appreciate that somebody has actually made an effort to interact with the stakeholders who raised those issues. And of course, there may still be room for further engagement on those issues, the 8 plus others. We then believe that we may be able to achieve addressing those things without necessarily calling for another round table on this matter, unless if it is on the issue of the program rollout review, which is actually something that the portfolio committee on an ongoing basis in terms of addressing the issue of compliance with the issues, the decisions, the policies, the programs that were introduced, we might want to do that as an oversight on that. But to then say whether we still need to have that roundtable where we engaged on the introduction of the program itself, it's my submission that as a committee we accept that we consider the matter as having been sufficiently handled. And therefore say that we lay the matter to rest for now and will on an ongoing basis do oversight role on the rollout of this induction program. But noting also that we will put an eye on those things that have not yet been embarked upon, that are packed but not abandoned, as the report suggests. Like the reorientation part of the program. So then, in terms of saying what is the way forward now, that's my submission, and I want to hear my colleagues pronouncing themselves in rejection of this proposal. No, that's on a lighter note. Does that actually cover our position, colleagues? Mr. Mene moves and then seconded. That then is the way we close this matter on the way forward. We encourage one-on-one in terms of stakeholders. Continue to engage. It does not necessarily require a roundtable that will actually continue to share our views on this matter. Thank you very much once more, Samdi. We close the first item, Prof. And colleagues, on the fourth consolidated M&E report of the Public Service Commission. I was advised that, yes, the way I closed that item is fine, but you see there is something called formality. I had indicated that the report is adopted with amendments. I had indicated that, but I'm told there is something called formality. Welcome, Kay. Welcomes K. You will assist us to strengthen the formality. The formality is that we want someone to move that report is adopted with amendments, so that what remains will be then before the chairperson to sign. Can I have a move? Member Tsomela is moving. Any second? Mr. Men is seconding. She wants it for the minutes. She's very strict, our secretary. Thanks for that. The last point is an announcement. We're supposed to have a meeting on Thursday on Friday, but due to tight schedules, there is what we call quarterly consultative forum where some of us have to participate. There is a meeting on Friday. That meeting would not be taking place. We're supposed to be having an opportunity with CETA for their budget and the performance overview and some latest amendments on their strategic plans. We are going to set a date for that, where we're going to look at it. On Wednesday next week, you remember we took a decision at our meeting last week on the Public Administration Management Bill to say we are going to have a workshop on the bill during the second week of August. The specific dates are the 12th and the 13th. Is that correct? The 12th and the 13th. We'll be submitting that. We just wanted firstly this meeting to be there to adopt that program, that we're going to have that workshop. When we considered the bill last week Wednesday, it was a draft bill, draft introduced in terms of Rule 159, which is actually meant for the committee to begin to plan in anticipation that the final bill will be introduced. That is what you see, the introduction of the intention to introduce the bill. So we dealt with the introduction of the intention to introduce the bill, and we responded accordingly and planned that we're going to have a workshop on the 12th and the 13th. But on Friday, that intention was now realized. The bill has now been introduced. It has been introduced, but not yet for formal consideration. It's actually introduced now in terms of joint rules 150 and 154, which is meant for us to comment on the classification of the bill. It's referred to us and the joint taking mechanism. I want to indicate that according to joint rule 154, as a committee, we have to operate according to and respond in terms of giving our submissions to the classification of the bill within a period not less than 3 days. And a period not less than 3 days is that to allow that bill to be circulated, the ATC to be circulated. We are then saying members should look at that so that by Wednesday next week, we'll be able to submit our comments in terms of the classification. It may look like it's an administrative issue. It is not. The draft bill that was submitted to Parliament in terms of Joint Rule 159 classified the bill as a Section 75 bill. The Friday bill, which is now no longer a draft, classified the bill as a Section 76. Committees of Parliament, members of the National Assembly and members of the NCOP are required in terms of the rules of Parliament to exercise to give an opinion on the classification. That's why it's referred to us. Honorable Mene will remember when we're debating and everybody, we said that we will give this bill the attention it deserves. And this is part of contributing in making sure that we give it the attention it deserves. So I'm submitting that copies will be circulated, Mr. Secretary. Yeah, copies will be circulated, and when we have those copies, let's look at that. Let's actually do consult whoever. But on Wednesday, we are taking a decision next week to then say, comment and refer and influence the classification process. Thanks. Before closing the meeting, I said, Prof, you will have an opportunity to say goodbye, and even on behalf of our visitors, our guests, you will convey our apology if we performed less than their expectation.
Thank you very much, Chair. I think I would crave your indulgence and actually ask if you would give my colleague here the opportunity to pass judgment on your performance here, but I'm pretty certain this has been a very instructive session for all of us, even for myself. It's been a very, very helpful and useful session. Particularly, I like the combination of the discussions here involving Sunday. I've learned a lot on the kinds of issues on which there is need to keep on the consultation. And I like the term that was used to describe that, the conversations. I think conversation is a very useful term, constructive conversation, which I understand has been taking place between Sambi and the Ops. But with your indulgence, Chair, can I give this opportunity to Mr. Balam? Thank you.
At this juncture, I would like to thank the Chair of Portfolio Committee, Mr. Richard, and the members. It has been a moving experience for us from Southern Sudan to come and attend this forum. I wouldn't say that that I'm privileged, but I'm really touched by your warm welcome to us. Let me tell you that you are very far here from, at the Cape Town here at the coast, but back in Johannesburg and Pretoria. It's a way with Southern Sudanese coming to South Africa to come and learn experiences so that they can be able to develop their war-ravaged country for the last 45 years of their independence. And I would commend the role of the Public Service of South Africa, Professor Sangwane and the team, for their dedication and commitment to raise our portfolio so that we can interact with our public service committee like the one you have here. I'm really moved, and I'm taking the message from that people in South Africa, and especially the parliament that is overseeing the service delivery to the public, is really a good committee, given the fact that parliament is parliament with so many committees, but this committee is the lifeline of the people of South Africa. And as the chair person put it, that South Africa has a very high profile, and I would say that through the Public Service Committee, please take care of Southern Sudan. We are infants. We are being bullied by our big brother. Thank you so much, and I've enjoyed. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. We are all invited to have lunch, which is at the cafeteria next door. Our secretary will lead us there. The meeting is adjourned. Thanks.